Hi there, folks, and welcome or welcome back to Nippon Trading International's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis of realestate.jp. He's a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families who are looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for over two decades now. And for about half of that time, he's been buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in Tokyo on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So he's got dedicated loan officers in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions, which means that you're already aware of the fact that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on sales@realestate.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. All right, so for today's episode, we're back with the JREP panel. And by the way, if you still haven't pre-registered for our upcoming February Japan Real Estate Summit seminar in Tokyo, what are you waiting for? Get over to realestate.jp and put your name in now, because places are limited. Last time we at NTI had a seminar in Tokyo, it was a full house, standing room only, and that was just a couple of us talking heads. This time around, there are five of us, each with our own unique knowledge and expertise, so a really good chance to pick our brains for the day, and all but guaranteed to be sold out. So yeah, realestate.jp, go and register. So yeah, back with the JREP panel today, and we're discussing a few topics and questions that came up in our Japan Real Estate group on Facebook. Great group, by the way. We'll link to it in this episode's show notes if you're still not familiar with it. And one of these topics was the sensitive matter of stubborn tenants. So what can you do if you've got plans for your property but have a tenant in it? They may have been there for a while, you don't want to disrupt their lives, but you also need to think of your own financial position. How do tenant rights work in Japan in this respect? And what can you do as a landlord when you simply need your tenants to vacate the property? We also talk about a similar case on a grander scale of the famous Narita Airport farmers. Really interesting story if you're not familiar with it. And then we segue to another question, this one from a YouTube viewer who's asking about beach holiday properties in Japan. Are they a good purchase? Are they popular? Are they priced correctly or are they overpriced? How susceptible are they to natural disasters and in particular tsunamis, which are always a painful topic here? And then after that, we riff a little bit about international schools and other projects that can breathe life into otherwise unknown Japanese countryside towns and prefectures. So a really good, well-rounded conversation with the usual suspects. Enjoy the ride, and I'll see you again on the other side. All right, and we're back. Our listeners and viewers don't actually know how long we've been off because they see the gap in publishing, not the gap in actually recording. But we haven't gotten together for over a month, right?
Yes, 5-6 weeks.
Yeah.
And how many countries have we visited in that time?
Yes, let's make people jealous. Tell us about it.
Okay, well, I think I went out first. So I did Qatar, I did Czech Republic, I did Austria, Poland, Nigeria, Germany, back to Czech, then Austria again, then here. So I was all over the place. So now I'm going crazy. Like I have multiple jet lags and
everything. A backlog of 6 weeks of emails, right?
Yeah, well, yes, that's true. And I came back and literally within 48 hours, I left to Kyoto and came back last night.
Nice.
So actually last morning we drove, so we came back 5 a.m.
Yesterday. It's a nice drive.
You drove from Kyoto?
Oh yeah, it was awesome. My husband got a new toy, so we went out for a test drive.
Nice. So how long does it take to drive to Kyoto?
Going there took us 5.5 hours.
Oh, okay, it's not too bad.
It's not bad at all. Sometimes you do longer if you go to Shimoda. Going back, it took us seven, because there was basically there were some repairs on the express right when you get off Kyoto, which we didn't know about, that they're gonna close the express, that they close the express every night from 8 p.m. We didn't know that. So we got to the express and they go like, oh, you know, the express is closed, go down. And we were like, but up there. And they said, we don't know, just go down.
Just go.
Get out.
Oh dear.
So
oh,
yeah, dear. So it took us seven going back, but we are two drivers. So for us, it's not a problem.
Yeah, the only thing is if you're not using the motorway, you get stuck behind one of those trucks on a single lane, and then it's a bit of a nightmare, isn't it?
You know, it is highway almost all the way, but going there on Friday night, we were almost alone. Going back Monday night, there were trucks throughout. I've never seen as many trailers in Japan as I've seen on Monday. And there were just too many. We were basically all the time in between some trucks that they would go, so we would go a little bit ahead, but it slows you down a lot. And it's also quite uncomfortable because, you know, the truck drivers are not the nicest, so.
Yeah, you're constantly like braking.
Yeah, you are. And then, you know, when they decide they want to take over, even there is no space, they just go on you.
Yeah.
And hope you're going to slow down. So, yeah, there was a lot of swearing involved.
Swerving or swearing?
Swearing.
Yeah. How were your flights? Did you get a lot of delays or changes or issues with the testing or?
I'm the worst person to ask about that. I have spent about 4 hours on calls with airlines in general because of our change of plans and change of flights, because we had the summer planned out completely different. Then we had to change due family situation. So we had to change some of the routes of our flights. We had to change dates. We had to cancel some parts of the tickets. Yeah.
But that was your changes. I mean, they didn't.
Luckily, only one was not my change. That was Lufthansa, because when I was flying to Africa, that day Lufthansa was on strike. They decided to get on strike in Germany for all that matters. I was like, how? I would expect this in France, but I would never expect it from Lufthansa.
There's some solidarity during these pandemic times to postpone the strikes till after the pandemic.
You know, I mean, listen, in Europe, pandemic is over. What pandemic?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Australia felt the same, actually.
It's literally only Japan that it's still overreacting over this thing. So Europe, nobody cares about anything regarding to corona.
I mean, when has that not been the case?
No, I mean, for a while Europe was pretty strict,
yeah,
you know, with a lot of things, but right now nobody cares about anything. But they had some, you know, I guess salary issues, whatever. So on the same day that I was to fly to Nigeria, they decided to get on strike. So I just got a message as I was going to the airport a day ahead, so to kind of hang out and have fun with my girlfriend in Austria. They sent me a ticket. Oh, by the way, your flight tomorrow was canceled. So I was like, hold on a second.
At least told you, wait till I get to my store.
No, they sent me an email. They didn't call, they sent me an email. Luckily, I check my emails regularly because, you know, we're getting old work emails and stuff. Like, I check my emails all the time. So it was like, oh, by the way, your flight is canceled. So I was like, what the hell? Tried to call them. Of course, all the phone lines were down. No chat support, nothing. So then all of somehow miraculously they figured out that I was inquiring, and they sent me another email that they rerouted me through Amsterdam with a little bit of a longer wait, but at least
could be worse. I can take
could be worse, and I
take some time out in Amsterdam waiting for another flight.
Yeah. We all can do that. So luckily, and I had to get to Nigeria at a specific time because I was going for a funeral. So I didn't really have the luxury of saying, oh, I'll just go next week, or I'll go in whatever 2 days or 3 days when Lufthansa start flying again. So I had to take, and so I checked in for the flight through Amsterdam and everything. And when I came to the airport in the morning and tried to check in my luggage, they start telling me, I have to fly through Charles de Gaulle. And I was like, nope, not doing it. I got just so pissed off. So I was standing at the counter with my luggage, and I said, I'm not checking in through Charles de Gaulle. I'm not flying through that airport. It's the worst airport in Europe. So I was like, nope, nope, and nope. And you already checked me in. I'm online checked in through Amsterdam. You have to put me through Amsterdam. So they saw I'm not leaving. So they did that. So I did. You know.
Where did you go, Tracy?
I was in Thailand.
Yeah, I know. So it was a rhetorical question. I hate your guts.
Yeah. Enough. But it was fantastic because I got to see my family for the first time in 3 years. My mum and dad, they flew up from Australia and we flew down and we had we're Marriott share, like we're Marriott points owners. So, you know, we have like we have these massive apartments in Thailand that we have. So, two and three bedroom apartments, which is just fantastic. So we could all just hang out. I mean, hotel rooms are so small, but when you have an apartment, you know, everyone, like my dad needs an afternoon sleep. So and everyone gets their own space and you can read and just be. It's just that's what you really miss, seeing family. It's like, yes, you can catch up on all the news. You can do that over Zoom. But just to be in the same room and breathe the same air, there's just something really special about that. So. You know, we went swimming and my mum got to read books with my son every day. So that was just awesome. Being in a resort, it's just lush, having people come and make your beds every day. It was really lush. Massages on the beach. And the thing about Thailand is that pretty much everyone's still in masks. And my parents who flew up from Australia, you know, they use the same paper mask day upon day, and I'm like, oh, stop this, you know, because they're not used to the mask culture. So I gave them a whole bunch of masks and I taught them how to use them again. So even Bangkok, it's everyone's in masks. And coming back in now, probably when this airs, it's going to be over, but you know, we had to get the PCR tests and nearly had to sell my child into slavery to buy the PCR test and the certificate. It's horrendously, it's such a rot. Yeah. We did a drive through PCR tests with a golf buggy because we were on foot. They put us on a little golf buggy. I've got photos to prove it that we went through. We went through the drive-through PCR tests on a golf buggy, which was hilarious. It's lovely. It was just really nice. And now back into it. Yeah, back into it. Mm. And Ziv, you've had a bit of a rough start, didn't you?
The start, yeah, wasn't too bad. I just wish they'd notified us. So an airline whose name I shall not mention for fear of retribution, have decided to cancel our flight from Tokyo to Australia without actually notifying us. And we're coming in from the other side of the country. So we just rocked up to a very, very deserted, abandoned kind of airline counter to find out that we're not flying anywhere. And they did put us on a flight the next day, but it was just an extra bit painful 29 extra hours because the Narita, no offense if any of our viewers live around Narita, but it's a bit of a dump aside from the airport. Like there's just nothing there, even in the heart of the town. There's like some snack bars, that's it.
Yeah.
I thought that there was a really nice temple and stuff in there. People have said to me, oh, Narita town is actually really interesting because there's a really nice temple, or is that just an urban?
No, it could be. I just haven't seen it anywhere near the
north of it can be kind of along, what is that, the Tone River, I think. Yeah. Probably like 20 kilometers or so north. The northern area of Narita can be, but yeah, generally speaking, I fully agree with Ziv, except for the very interesting, I believe it's the five farmers who still live in the middle of Narita Airport.
Oh, really?
They don't.
Oh, there's a story. Wait, give it to me.
You don't know about this?
No. Oh, this was...
Oh, it's great. So what do you call that when the government acquisitions land?
Forced eviction.
Eminent domain.
Eminent domain. Yeah, exactly.
Right. And so when Narita Airport was being built, I mean, you guys, especially you, Ziv, would probably know more about it, but it was sort of like forced eviction.
Yeah.
But with like tenants' rights, right? And so there are a bunch of people living in, mostly farmers living in the areas. And, you know, the government comes in and says, hey, we're building an airport here. Like, here's some money. Get out. Most of them did it, except for five. And they were like, no. And so they're still there, like in, I believe it's in between like two tarmacs, like in the middle of Narita Airport. There's these five or six farmers that still, they still have their land. They refuse to leave. They won't take the money. And they're just like, look it up, like Narita farmers or something.
I mean,
they're, what, they're like in the middle of the tarmac?
Yeah, like they are in what is otherwise known as Narita Airport.
I remember the first time I came to Japan, which was in the late 80s. When you go back through Narita, there was actually a passport check before you got onto the land, and because there was such a protest that was going on, and bombings and, you know, or threatens of bombs and stuff like that because of all of this. And I didn't realize those people were still living there.
I guess it sounds like it's one now. I just sent a link in the chat, but there's at least one person who lives in the middle, like not even like, what was that Tom Hanks movie where he gets stuck in the airport? This person has a farm within Narita Airport.
Wait, Tracy, can you share that? Let's show people. Is there a photo there or something? Or just a video?
I'm just trying. I've actually got my browser shut to save on memory.
Let me share my screen. Oh, you have to disabled.
Oh, I have to let you. Look, I'll help you.
Put it in the episode notes.
Show notes, yeah.
Oh. Yeah. But yeah, there's that at least one dude who's just like,
That's hilarious, though.
Yeah. Apparently, it's worth $1.6 million.
No kidding.
Yeah.
No
kidding. He still is just like, nope.
He's lucky that they don't just kind of carried him out, because in Europe there were a few issues over this in the past 30 years, and basically, so to avoid this, they did some kind of a law that you're not allowed, that if it's for the higher good,
right,
of the country or of the community or whatever, and so you can't even haggle the price.
Mm-hmm.
Because what they used to do in Czech, they would hold up, and then they'll be the last, and they'll be like, "Well, you paid them, for example, 100,000, but I'm the last, and without me, you can't do it. So you gotta give me 10 million."
Yeah, right.
Right, and then the developer eventually, you know, would settle for example, a million, mm-hmm. but that would still be much more than what's supposed to. So now, right now, it is you have to take the price that is like for everybody. Given by the government.
I actually, new information has come to light. There are five households still living on Narita Airport grounds, quote, the son of one of the men who refused to leave still farms his land, assisted by 10, count them, 10 volunteers, some of whom were former student protesters.
How do you farm in the middle of the airport?
No idea.
No idea. I would not want to eat that produce, to be honest.
That too, right? Like it's
jet fuel, that's right.
Yeah, it's very
How bloody minded do you have to be, really? Like
That is a next level stubbernness.
It's very cute. It's endearing, I have to say. It's quite We actually had this is a perfect segue, actually, because we had a question in the group that riled up a lot of people in the Japan Real Estate group on Facebook, which if our viewers are not members of, they definitely should be. Somebody was asking, let me dig that up. Somebody was asking, what can you do if you purchase an older building and it's got tenants in it, but you actually want to build something else there? Obviously, you don't forcibly kick them out, but what do you do? And there was a bunch of very interesting answers, but before I dive into them, what do you think, folks?
We're actually kind of in a situation like this right now.
Okay.
I won't give any names, locations, blah 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 blah, whatever, but it's what you describe. There's a number of ways to do it. You can be a complete jerk and say, hey, I'm the owner. Get out.
Yeah. But they do have a legal leg to stand on if they don't want to.
Well, it depends on what kind of property you're talking about. If it's in arrears with the bank, then you've got a little bit more force behind you, right? You can do that, but especially in, you know, I deal in mostly rural stuff, right? The situation is that this is a rural community. The property in question is kind of a long-standing member of said rural community. They have connections, people know each other, blah, 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 blah. And if the parties who are interested in said property end up making a purchase, who are unknown to the local community, and they come in there and acquire the what amounts to, I guess you could call it, a historic property that everybody knows and is familiar with, and just run in there and kick everybody out and start their whole thing up, that doesn't really do you any favors with everybody who surrounds your property. You basically make enemies by doing that, right?
Probably not too popular even with the ward office, right?
Precisely. And so there's a number of ways to do it. Our suggestion at the moment is, look, in order to get everybody on your good side, the community, as well as the people that you are acquiring this property from, who happen to live on the property currently, in addition to a few others, up your budget so that you can move them, you can relocate them, and offer to pay like a year's rent for wherever it is you put them.
Considering that in Japan it costs you about 6 months rent to even move anywhere, that's not an unreasonable deal, I think.
Right. And so, of course, obviously that means additional costs to the purchase, but if you've got the means and you're not against making less hassles for yourself, the current best approach to that issue, I would say, is bite the bullet and be a nice person and be like, all right, we understand that, you know, basically we're evicting or kicking you out, but we want to make sure you land on your feet. You know, here's a good spot. Probably you should be the one who's deciding on where to put them. But basically give them an olive branch and say, we understand that this is a difficult situation. We don't want to put you out on the street. So how about this? So it's kind of a, what would you call that, a middle ground sort of thing.
That's definitely the nice way to do it, I think. I mean, there's horror stories, you know, from outright illegal old school stuff, like sending yakuzas to hit the doors with baseball bats and threaten people. And the gray area, which we've seen actually happen on a few occasions, with, you know, when a developer buys the building, they get their 80%, which is what you need by law, 80% agreement from unit owners to sell. And then if there happen to be 10 or 20% that don't want to sell, they retain their units. So the developer can't tear down the building. But what they can do is stop water supply because they now own the infrastructure, for example, or stop electricity supply or what have you. And then, you know, they're effectively forced to move out because they just can't live there anymore. And by that point, they can't even negotiate a price anymore. They just have to basically give it away.
There you go. Right.
Well, look, I know people who have done very well out of the, it's not really an eviction. It's more like, we would like, you know, you have tenants' rights, you know, you have a contract, you're all paid up. This is for renters. And we want this building. And so I've had a few friends hold out, managed to do very nicely out of that, and yeah, you know, enough so that they were able to buy a house or buy a house free and clear from the penalty of you know, for the hassle of moving out. So it's interesting.
Also important to note that Japanese tenants being conflict averse, in most cases, you know, farmers in the midst of Narita Airport notwithstanding, but in most cases they would accept a reasonable offer relatively easily and quickly. And you know, sometimes we just say, look, we're not renewing the lease because, for example, the owner wants to move into the property, and they'll just move out. We'll give them a bit of compensation and they'll move out. But if you happen to get a foreign tenant, I'm sorry to say, who actually knows their rights as well they should, or if you happen to have one of these stubborn old men or stubborn old farmers, usually men, I find, maybe because they have more time on their hands or they're bored or I don't know. It can be a bit of a hassle.
We're going to be facing that shortly in one of my rentals. They've put up a sign at the beginning of the block. It's like in Shinjuku area, and it looks like that they're going to acquire the whole city block. It's like a massive block, and it's full of smaller places, older houses, and lots of bitsy botsy places. But it is 1 minute walk from Shinjuku to Okoen, so Shinjuku Central Park. So it is like valuable real estate. So, but I rent a house there from an owner, and so I'm madly checking my contracts to see, well, if I keep paying my rent, to the owner. So it's up to the owner to sell or not. And then, so if the owner sells, that's fine, but the owner is selling on the basis that there's an ongoing contract. So I'm just going to wait and see. But it's going to take years and years and years because it's a massive development. So
it's probably going to be a bit more challenging in your case because you're not actually living there. So you're effectively running a business, by virtue of the sublease, I imagine, right?
Sure. But that's a... But we have a legal and binding contract, and it's very like we have it all on paper. And this is, if anyone's watching this, if you ever think that you're going to be doing short term rentals with it, as a sublet without telling the owners, just forget about it. That's never ever going to happen. So you have to have the permission of the owner, the blessing of the owner. You'll usually pay above market rates, and I've been a good tenant. I'm quiet. I'm clean. And I pay on time, I pay over and above rates, keep the outside nice because I have to, it's my business. But I'm just sort of sitting there going, ooh, how much are they going to pay?
As a business, Tracy, as a business, you might be able to a bigger payout actually than as a private person.
Because it's future earnings, right?
Yeah. Yes, it's a future earnings. A friend of ours, they got asked to leave a building like that where they were running their business, and they had to pay them a lot of money, a lot. He got a lot.
Did they have to threaten or
no, basically the building got sold and was to be torn down and rebuilt, and they said, well, but and at that time, they still had like a long time contract. So they said, nope, we are not leaving. We have a building, we have a contract. We have a contract here, we have a business here, we are not leaving. And they got a lot at last to leave.
The advice to the person who's writing into the Facebook group is that have this in the back of your, like, have this as a budgeted line item. You are going to have to pay.
Yeah.
You are going to have to pay compensation to anyone that has a valid contract. And so use that in your numbers to make sure before you go into a project that.
Yes, before you buy a building like that. I personally would never actually buy a building that I'm planning to like evict.
Do something else with. Yeah.
Do something else with. Before having some sort of agreement and stuff, because
it's not just the cost of the compensation itself. You also need to factor in the length of time that it will take you, because that's also lost income.
That's dead money. That's dead money. At that point, your investment is tied up. But and then whether it is a building with apartments or is building where you can do for business. I heard something and I can't confirm it completely, but I think if you are paying rent somewhere for a long period of time at the same property,
gives you more rights. Yes, I heard that.
You too. Have more rights, and after, I don't know if it's a 20 or 30 years, you kind of can't be asked to leave
You can always be asked, but you definitely
you can be asked, but like you have the right to stay or something like that. Yeah. It's a little bit confusing to me, but my husband was telling me something to that effect, and I think it was like 30 years or either 20 or 30 years if you are at the same property, that they actually cannot kick you out.
Same thing with squatters' rights.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah, they do exist in Japan. Nobody, not many people actually squat, but they do. You squat, do you, Matt?
You manage to squat for 20 years in a property, it is yours.
Yeah.
20. Actually, also, that might be also the same thing with what my husband was telling me about, because I think he said 20 years, and even if you stop paying rent at that point,
yeah,
they
yeah.
can't.
That's squatters' rights.
Okay.
Yeah. You see. People make people actually I don't know if business, but people actually actively seek to reach that position in other countries.
I think I've heard of one person who managed to do it in Japan, like the 20 years, and like, all right, free and clear. This is my building now.
But, wow.
But these are, again, I mean, these are not your typical Japanese tenants. Like anybody who would actually, you know, wrap their head around even doing yeah. something like that is going to be a problem, no matter what sort of compensation you are. Yeah. We normally tell our customers that, you know, if and when they do have this kind of plan and they have long-term tenants who maybe are not too interested in leaving, it's not nice to say, but because it's your building now, you can turn any of the units into minpaku, for example.
Oh, that'll get people out fairly soon.
Right, exactly.
I think all you'd need to do would be put a letter into as a heads up saying, oh, I've bought the building now.
This is just short-term to let
you, just to let you know that because apartments 3, 4, and 5 are now empty, I'm going to be turning those into minpaku, just as a heads up, you know, and
ooh,
then
people, I like that.
Yeah. And then people will tend to move, like, you know, because
foreigners will be coming in and out at all hours of the night.
but you give people the polite heads up. Yeah. You know, if there's any problems, talk to me or the rest of it. But that people will tend to leave of their own accord. And the thing is, if you've got a 20 unit building, you're not going to turn them all into minpaku anyway immediately because it just takes too much time.
We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, if that's still a thing, or if you just need somewhere quiet to get away from the world. They offer a variety of options for families, corporate relocations, or even if you're simply transitioning between homes in Tokyo. The properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They come with fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens. And they're just a delight to stay in, fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know they're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own, but longer term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly in a Japanese business hotel. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, etc., you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profit, or a holiday home that you want to rent out when you're not using it via short-term stays, drop them a line today, see how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth a visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at sales@realestate.jp. And now back to the podcast.
What I went and got actually is, you know, like I said, my house the whole block is going to be taken over. The community have started a campaign.
Nice.
And they So it's like a bit of a grassroots campaign. So,
but don't destroy our building kind of thing.
Well, no, it's basically like, let's organize and like, let's get as much money as we can from these people.
Oh, I like that.
That's good. Awesome.
Yeah. So I don't know if you could, is this back to front? Let me see.
No, we can see it well.
Yeah. So it's basically like, you know, don't let these evil corporations like shortchange us and let, you know, they're going to be making billions out of this deal. So let's, you know, band together and stand up for our rights type of thing. That's what this is. That's what this is all about. And it's like,
honestly, like by virtue of our position, we should actually be in the buyer or the landlord. But all we've had in our experience was actually from the opposite side. So we have customers who owns units in buildings, like, you know, a single room or a one apartment or two apartments. And those developers are not nice. Like they come in, first of all, they come in kind of like under the radar and they buy two or three or four units at market price, like just pretending to be normal buyers. And then that gives them votes on the owner union. And then they start pushing the head of the owner union with semi-legal bribes and vacations of various sorts. And they, together with the head of the owner union, then try to convince everybody else during the business meet, during the owner union meetings that, and these are people that usually are not professional investors, so they're more susceptible to this kind of scare tactic. And oh, the building's getting old, maintenance is gonna high. Oh, you don't know what we're offering you now is the best you'll ever get for it. And they eventually push and push, and they got their time. They take 2, 3, 4 years, and they eventually get their way. So they're not nice. They're definitely not nice.
Well, the good thing about being a foreigner in that case is that you can sort of block it out a little bit.
We're not even attending those meetings.
Yeah.
Yeah. By the time we are forced to sell, it's not at a good price, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, that's a really good question from our community. So keep them coming. What did you do to your hand, Ziv? Sorry to change the subject.
Like a burn. Is that a burn?
It is a burn.
Oh, that's right. Fireworks.
Yes, I'm kind of embarrassed.
Oh, yeah, that you had a hell of a...
I thought it was a good idea. You know how, like, when you light a cigarette, you're shielding the flame with your hand because it's windy? Yeah. Right. I kind of thought it was a good idea to help my son light a firework that way, and it worked. The firework went off.
Right. Hey, man. Success.
Crikey.
That's why men are younger.
And your son learned a lesson. So it's a double win.
He was so sweet. He kept running to me with ice packs. Like, are you okay? Yeah, go light him. It's okay.
Oh, bless. Oh dear. Do we have another question from the gallery?
So we have one that we're going to save for a special guest who's going to be joining us on another occasion. So I'm not going to tell you that one. But we have one. Could you please discuss beach and ocean properties near Tokyo, like Atami, Izu, Chiba, and similar locations, and what you think about value/investment? Given that the Japanese don't seem to value ocean properties due to tsunami risk, plus minus maintenance, and so forth. So there's a lot to unpack there. But I want to first question the assumption that Japanese don't like them. Is that true?
Japan doesn't vote as a, like, it's not like a monolith, right? Like you've got...
but I wouldn't think, like, for example, properties in Shimoda are ridiculously expensive.
Hakone and a lot of other places as well. Yeah.
You know, so I think it depends on the area.
Because I was
looking at some properties, and Shimoda is really up there. Even just to get even land, I saw a nice land, to be honest, in Shimoda, it was 600 square meters. I think it was 600 square meters. Yeah, 600 square meters. So, you know, not a bad property if you want to do something on it. Definitely very big if you want it as a personal one. And the property alone was 35 million yen. But it was perfect because it was by Shirahama.
That's the other thing about Shimoda, is like
it's so far from Tokyo.
When it comes up for us, legitimately, if you want to move there,
or yeah,
if you want a second house or like a Bessel or big or whatever, like you're legit looking at what, at least 10 hours driving every time you go down.
It should be every weekend.
Educated lifestyle choice.
Yeah.
I mean, there's the Odoriko. If you're not, but I mean, that's the other thing too. What we advise,
like once a day.
It's like three or four, but yeah, it's not that many. And so like, if you want a Bessel down there, we advise this for places like Minakami as well. It's like, all right, fine. Pick up the house, whatever. Also buy a parking spot and have your car for down there so that you don't have to drive there. You take the train there, which is easy enough. And then once you get there, you've got your local transportation. But if you're either training and only training, which means either cabs or walking once you get there, or driving, which means it's not really
It's that's what I would recommend for Shimoda, is have a car there, or you know, just because cars are cheap, man. You can pick up
a really cheap car for like $3,000 or whatever.
Exactly. And then just have it, if you're gonna you know, spend out, like open your wallet to buy something in Shimoda, then have a car there and then just catch the train, because then you can just like relax on the train and, you know, hang out. You're not sort of,
but like, a family of, if you think about it, family of four going there by train and back every weekend, it's not a very economical either. So
my quality of time, and then you have a life, Blanca, my quality of life is much better on a train, especially with kids. With kids in a car, oh my god, no!
Yeah, trains are the way to go if you can afford it.
Look, we're gonna disagree on this.
I mean, hey, I'm looking at a spot in Shimoda right now that's going for 68 million. It's got 1,403 square meters of land.
Ooh, and
243.56 meters square.
Gorgeous, gorgeous. Is it by the beach?
It is in Yoshisami. So hold on,
no idea where that is.
But there's a ton of places up around, you know, like Chiba Peninsula, sort of anywhere from like you know, anything that's like on that coast, of course.
Katayama, Kanagawa.
Anywhere from Katayama to Onjuku and like Ohara.
The beach is not that nice.
Well, I mean, Onjuku beach is fine, right? I mean,
it's nothing. The problem is, it's nothing comparing to Shimoda. So you are compromising. So you compromise either the quality of the beach or the commute.
Well, so here's the other thing too. Let's stick with Shimoda for a minute. The spot that I'm looking at right now, it's a little bit further. It's near Yumigahama.
Mm-hmm.
It's further down. But if you're looking at Shimoda, you should also be looking right next door at Kawazu, which is like 10 kilometers away.
Kawazu is lovely.
Kawazu is great. I absolutely adore Kawazu.
Okay, but wait, hang on. Aside from lifestyle choices, are lifestyle choices, holiday home or not, or if you want to move there, value investment-wise, are they even something to be considered as investment properties if it's a beachside potentially you could turn it into a guest house, but aside from that,
well, so think about it this way, like for example, with between Manazuru and Atami, so Manazuru, Yugawara, Atami, there's a lot of surfing and there's a whole lot of diving, especially in Manazuru. It's very
short-term stays, you're thinking.
Yeah, it's a very popular dive spot, so short-term stay or Airbnb, guest house, something like that. I mean, you know, there's pricing and costing and everything involved, but like, so far as just throughput is concerned, if your marketing is good, Manazuru is so goddamn popular and I enjoy the place, but like the part of it is just like, why not Yugawara? Maybe it's just cause I live here. But
too many people that look like you.
Right. Most of the divers, the surfers, the people who want these areas that go to the guest house and stuff, guess what? They're in the IT industry. They've got money. They just don't look like it, right?
Yeah.
But not definitely not long-term tenants. Like, you wouldn't actually find
No, it's a short-term. It's definitely, it's great if, I would say, it's a great idea if you yourself want to have a second home in those area.
And then rent it out part-time.
You And then for the time you are not there, you rent it out.
Yeah.
And that goes back to the discussion we had a while back that you want to use it during high season, but that's exactly when you potentially
when they want to use it. Right? But you can block out if you are busy, you are not there every weekend anyways.
Yeah.
So right, you just block out the times when you want to be there. We just had an offer on a similar concept, but in Minobu.
Yeah, see, people like us can go during the week, right? We can go during the week.
If you're a business owner.
Work from there, right? And you could work from, like Blanca, you could work from there. Matt, you could, you know, we can all work from the second house. I'm looking at sort of the, I'm looking at the Chiva side just because of the time it takes to transfer. Yeah.
But value-wise.
I'm looking at Chiva too because it's closer. Close to you. As much as I love Shimoda. After I got stuck there one time for 8 hours on the way back between Shimoda and Tokyo.
Sunday night, was it?
I've got a way worse.
Beginner's mistake, Sunday night. And since then, we do it the way that we either leave right after lunch. So you don't do it one day trip. You kind of stay 2-3 days. And on the day when you leave, we leave like 1 p.m. or whatever. Or then you have to stay and leave like 9 p.m.
Yeah, I only did that once in my life, driving into Tokyo Sunday evening. I will never try that again.
Never, ever.
No matter what you do.
Okay, value-wise, do we think they could potentially hold their value? I'm seeing the opposite. I'm seeing them actually losing value a lot more.
It totally depends on where it is. If it's Shimoda or like Southern Izu. I mean, let's think about it logically, right? The beach areas that are readily accessible for Tokyoites, let's say, are going to be along Sagami Bay and on the west side, or I'm sorry, east side of Izu, and then the eastern Chiba coast. Personally, I think the eastern Chiba coast is not worthwhile, which leaves Sagami Bay and eastern Izu. Shimoda, mega difficult to get to, kind of a waste of time. It's great when you're there, but oh my gosh, talk about stress and just all that stuff involved. And so really, it's Sagami Bay. And then if you look at Sagami Bay, though, anything past about Odawara tends to be within the realm of what somebody might consider affordable. But if you're going back up towards the city, back towards Tokyo, along the Tokaido, along the Sagami Bay, I mean, it just gets more and more and more expensive. I mean, Chigasaki, Hiratsuka right now are blowing up. Obviously, Kamakura and Zushi are still very, and Hayama.
They're really, Zushi, Hayama, they're really holding their value.
And so if you got the cash to throw down, okay, that might be a good investment. But if, especially if it's your first rodeo and you kind of want to go in cheap, maybe not cheap, but, you know, going low, right?
So similar dynamics to other locations in Japan. If you're close to the city, you might retain your value. Otherwise, don't expect that, right?
Yes, but you can. But those places that are on the beach during the pandemic, anywhere that was a drive-to location during the pandemic, they killed it on short term.
Yeah,
absolutely.
No, short term stay could be a
and that so it's a. It's a toss up between long term capital gain versus like, you know, short term cash flow. So definitely short term cash flow, it's there, and you're going to be able to, especially during the summer months, you know, March through to October, you're going to be able to really crank up your cash flow, and you know, it'll pay for itself in no time at all if you do it short term.
Okay, and then the last factor, Blanca probably has something to say about that, is maintenance, right? I know that we have a few that are beachside that we do need to paint and anti-rust and replace parts of on a much more frequent basis than other properties, right?
Definitely, because the salty air and everything, the water, it even like you can see a bed for door frames and the doors and everything. Lot of things
everything
gets damaged much more, so you have to account for that. We had a client that was trying to do a property in Atami, and just looking at it is, you know, that the repairs and
they
everything
tend to look like shit very quickly, I think.
And that's kind of a funny element to it all, is that occasionally, you know, we've got, I mean, honestly, most of our clientele is pretty top tier, a lot of them are relatively adventurous, aren't so concerned with, you know, always looking totally perfect and driving an AMG Mercedes wherever they go and whatnot. Some of them do, though, want to do that, right? And when they bring up seaside properties, I mean, at this point now, we just got to be like, seriously? Like, you?
the tsunami factor? The guy was asking about the tsunami factor. Is that something that, I mean, I've written an article ages ago about it. I think we're not really prepared for the waters rising and so forth.
Tsunami inundation.
Is that something that people are thinking about?
Yeah, tsunami inundation zones are certain. And of course, every municipality has different hazard maps. It's a pain in the ass because they're all PDFs and you can't, like, you know, click one on and then another.
Textless off. PDFs, shall we point out, right? Graphic PDFs.
So like, for example, recently in our newsletter, we wanted to kind of make an example of a place actually down here in Uvalde that's quite nice, very affordable, near the beach, 5-10 minute walk from this like awesome location, 9.5 million yen, really quite nice. However, it's in the tsunami inundation zone.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's, I mean, really what it comes down to is we live in Japan. There's volcanoes, there's tsunamis,
there's earthquakes.
Earthquakes, there's typhoons, there's murder hornets everywhere.
and goats.
Yeah, right. I've got a story about the goats actually recently, but I'll save that for later.
Well, and they say Australia's dangerous, for goodness sakes.
Right. Something that you have to be careful about, regardless of, you know, Akiya or super high quality new builds and whatnot, is, all right, check it out. We did our research, due diligence. Is it in a tsunami inundation zone? No. Is it in a potential landslide zone? Yes. Yeah. Okay. If that's the case, what are the developments around the property that you're considering? Because the whole risk with landslides isn't so much the fact that you've got runoff water coming down. It's that a developer was real shit, right, and didn't compact the soil properly or didn't do whatever when they purchased land. This is what happened in Atami. That's why that landslide last year happened.
Yeah,
it was a solar
and they were cutting out a lot of trees in that area.
They were doing that. It was a solar farm developer. And so that's why it happened. It was a man-made disaster that was exacerbated by the rainwater. And so it's not necessarily that, like, if you live in a risk zone, that equals it will happen. It's merely stating that, oh, okay, like, if it does happen, like, you might want to have a contingency plan. And if, so long as you understand your circumstances.
What is a contingency plan for tsunami danger?
So for a place like where I was just talking about in Uvalde, having a car, or actually, fuck the car, get a bike. Bikes are the best thing you can possibly have in a tsunami.
For doing something to potentially protect your property value, is there anything you can have?
Insurance.
Insurance.
That's it, right?
That's always it. Have a good insurance and always have everything you can in that insurance.
Yeah, right. So similar, exactly the same as you do with earthquakes, right? Which with can any strike property. Anywhere. They don't any necessarily property.
Have property. Tsunami insurance is not particularly popular. I remember, like, for 311, like, nobody had tsunami insurance.
But they've updated that now. So the policies that we've been getting include tsunami as
part of
the earthquake insurance because it's caused by an earthquake. I mean, tsunamis don't happen without an earthquake, right?
Okay, good, sure. good.
Interesting.
But yeah, so I mean,
no nuclear spillage insurance yet, but we're working on that one, hopefully. Yeah,
but it really just comes down to are you an intelligent person, but, like, you know, intelligent about the property. Like, okay, it's in this kind of place. What does that mean? If that thing happens, what do I do? Have I prepared for that and whatnot? If you do all of these things, then you can have a reason, I mean, reasonably have a very good time over a long time with whichever property it is you choose to purchase.
Basically, as with anything else you do, do your due diligence.
Yeah,
exactly.
Ask us.
We've done all the
research. Or pay somebody, pay an expert. Why, if you are already making an investment, pay an expert. You know, I always laugh. I know a lot of people like to do everything themselves, but...
Yeah, I laugh at them too. Like, you know what? You're opening yourself up to so much risk. It's a bad idea.
Yes. Yes. You know, there's a reason why there are people that are experts in anything and everything. Stop asking at Facebook forums.
Right.
Okay. The only thing you need to ask for is who can do this for me?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Who do I talk to? You know, because those are
things. It's good to educate yourselves publicly, but when you're actually
because they going give you
specific
10 different...
on a particular property, you want somebody to look into it for you.
Yeah, but they give you, like, every time when I read something, they give you 10 different opinions. None of them is
right.
Well,
and that's what they are, right?
Confuse you. They confuse you completely.
Yeah.
And it's like all they need to be told is talk to this person. This person, it's their business.
Right.
They know.
So, Ziv, I want to talk. I mean, we spoke about beach properties around Tokyo. There's a lot of other landmass besides sort of the Kanto plain. What is the beach and properties like around outside of Tokyo? I mean, you're in Fukuoka. Is there much demand in for beach areas outside?
So it very much depends on the local township and municipality, right? So just the fact that it's near a beach is not necessarily going to make it an attractive property, an attractive place to live, or an attractive place where you might get people to stay, right?
But because it's infrastructure, not just
it's infrastructure. It's got to be interesting aside from the beach. I mean, we're not in Thailand where all you need to do is, you know, whack a hammock between two trees and have somebody serving cocktails. It depends. So, you know, there's no convenience store. It's a 20-minute walk to the train station. So, yeah, I got a beach, but then what do I do after I get back from the beach, right? So there are communities like Itoshima, for example, west of Fukuoka, or, you know, Otaru up in Sapporo. There are communities that are near the beach and are popular, but that's because it's not just the beach there.
I'll be up in Otaru next month, actually.
Or the other thing is if you are a big developer, there is plenty of opportunity to actually, you know, get some land really quite cheap if you plan to put the infrastructure in as well.
That is a dream of, like, I want to see.
I just think there's so much, like, you know, don't go to where everyone else is. Go to where there's not people and actually build everything. It's just, you know, like there's a school being built up in Aomori right now, and it's a really, really expensive high-end boarding school, and they're doing exactly that. They've bought a ton of land in the middle of nowhere for nothing, and they're actually creating a whole, like, bubble of
is that by any chance in Kuroishi?
I don't know that. Well, I mean, it's in Aomori. It's a school called Haro, and they're really targeting, which is a British school, and they're really targeting high-end, you know, wealthy Chinese, wealthy Singaporeans, and it's not 9 million yen, 9 million yen a year for a full boarding for your kid, and so that's like, that's up there. And the thing is, they are filling it. They are gonna have no problem filling it. But they've been able to build this school for, you know, basically just for the cost of putting in these high-end buildings in there. So
they would need to build the area up, like you mentioned. They need to create that bubble. It's not just the cost of the development.
Sure, itself. And they've done all that. And they've been able to, you know, bring in local, local companies and you know, the things that they're able to offer is just their other schools are not able to offer that. So, you know, if you're really into skiing, you can go skiing every lunchtime. If you're into golfing, you can play golf at lunchtime, for example. Yeah. So these are the things that they can do because they've built their own ski field, or they're attached to a ski field, and they've got their own golf course. So they're doing all of that. But
and they've got, I'm assuming, the influence and the potential connections to actually bring people in to build whatever else needs to be built around them, right?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
You're right. We're just about at the end of it, I think.
Yeah, we're at the end of it. So
yeah.
We got a thing. So great talking. And next week too, we're doing that, right?
Yes, we are.
Surprise guest next week. Yes. Okay. I'll
stop. Time.
Back see ya.
Bye. See you, bye-bye.
Looking forward to
hang on the
everybody.
Line. Hang on the line.
So there you have it, the JREP crew doing what we do best, answering your questions and dishing out some valuable info for all of you out there with any interest in Japan's property market. And if you are, and also happen to be in Tokyo in February 2023, make sure to hop over to realestate.jp and pre-register for the inaugural Japan Real Estate Summit, Come say hi, pick our brains, and meet fellow like-minded real estate junkies like yourself. We can't wait to see you all there. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa, and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company, and you've got any sort of business or visa-related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com. And he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks, and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time, and until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku!